Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you've joined us. Today we're talking about zoos and other institutions that by definition keep animals confined. More than 180 million people visit American zoos every year, but in spite of their popularity, public sentiment against zoos has grown. In May, for example, a critically endangered gorilla named Harambee was killed at the Cincinnati Zoo after a four-year-old boy climbed into his enclosure. The incident sparked outrage at both the child's mother and the zoo, but some critics said the real crime was keeping Harambee captive in the first place. Zoos have evolved quite a bit since the early days of small, barren cages more than 100 years ago. Many have larger enclosures comprising features meant to replicate the animal's natural environment. And some zoos engaged the animals in enrichment activities meant to stimulate natural behaviors. Zoo advocates say an animal's quality of life at the zoo can actually be higher than in the wild. And they say zoos bring a host of benefits, including breeding and conservation programs, and a more enlightened public. But critics argue that the supposed benefits of zoos are overblown. If we're honest with ourselves, they say, zoos are mainly there to entertain us at the expense of the animals. Captivity is stressful, and the costs far outweigh the benefits, they argue. Zoos, they say, are simply unethical. Where do we go from here? My two guests today will help us talk through these issues. Here in studio with me is Michael McClure, general curator and elephant manager at the Maryland Zoo. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. And joining us by phone is Dale Jamieson, founding director of Animal Studies and Environmental Studies at New York University. Dale Jamieson is known, among other things, for an essay he wrote 30 years ago titled Against Zoos. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Sheila.
And let me start with you. You have written that there is, quote, a moral presumption against keeping wild animals in captivity. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is really very simple, that that intelligent creatures that have lives of their own, like us and like other non-human animals, everything else being equal, we want them out doing their thing. And so if we're going to bring them indoors and we're going to keep them under artificial conditions, we ought to have some pretty good reason for doing that, just as in the case of humans. We ought to have a pretty good reason for keeping them confined. Very simple thought, really.
And I mentioned in the intro, I don't know whether you heard, I mean, some of the arguments zoos make for what the reasons are to do that, what the benefits are.
Right.
So not persuasive to you?
Sorry?
Are those not persuasive to you?
Well, so the first thing to say is I don't think that zoos have no benefits at all. Obviously, they have some benefits. The question is really, are they worth the costs? And part of the problem is that when you actually look at what the supposed benefits are of zoos, it's really hard to get a kind of rigorous empirical case that they actually do achieve those goals. And part of the reason for that, of course, is that zoos really came into existence for really completely different purposes. They came into existence originally because they were sort of signs of power. They were part of the whole neocolonial enterprise. And then they became spaces for mass entertainment. And now they've taken on a kind of conservation function, or at least the rhetoric of conservation in science is a way of defending them. But there's fundamentally a tension or maybe even a contradiction between zoos as spaces of entertainment and zoos as conservation sites.
Let me pull Michael McClure into this conversation. You're a curator of a zoo. I assume you do think the benefits outweigh the costs.
Absolutely.
What would you describe as the main benefit of zoos?
Well, I think the main benefit of zoos is something that goes to that comment that Dale made about entertainment. I don't think defining entertainment just as, you know, a place or a thing that people come just to get a really quick fix and to be happy is enough. I think what we do in zoos is we connect people to the natural world. That's, you know, from the beginning, that's always been sort of the purpose of a zoo. And we've evolved over time, as Dale mentioned, and we've become much better at that. But the real benefits of that are we get people back into the natural world. We get people seeing animals as something that they might not get a chance to see otherwise.
So, Dale Jamison, let me ask you about that. I must say it reminds me of when I went from being a print reporter to a television reporter and had to make peace with the fact that we were constantly trying to grab eyeballs of people in very short news pieces and told ourselves, look, I'm trying to do some worthwhile reporting here, so it's okay that I'm also playing on the entertainment value. I mean, it seems to me, in a way, Mike McClure is saying the very thing that you're sort of dismissing as entertainment is what captures the attention of humans who go to zoos and gets them involved.
Well, I really have two problems with this. And the problem isn't so much that I want to say, no, it doesn't. Absolutely not, categorically so. The fundamental problem is really an empirical problem that we don't really know very much about what happens to people when they go to zoos. There really isn't much by way of really rigorous data that shows that people who go to zoos are in various ways more supportive of animal and environmental causes than other people. And if we look at this anecdotally, and that tends to be how it's looked at, I mean, people sort of report their experiences of going to zoos. One problem I have is, you know, I grew up in San Diego, so I spent a lot of my childhood at the San Diego Zoo. And I had all kinds of different sorts of experiences as a child at the zoo. But one experience that I had was that these animals are actually being kept there for our benefit. So there's kind of a lesson of domination or subordination that I think is for many people anyway, maybe not everyone, but is part of the zoo experience that I think is very hard to overcome.
Mike McClure, I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
I completely disagree that the animals are there for our benefit in some way. That is the exact opposite of how a modern accredited zoo really looks at what we're doing. The animals are there so that we can absolutely benefit them. I mean, literally, it is all for the animals. We spend day in, day out working with them, ensuring that they have excellent welfare, and also studying these animals and learning things that in turn then benefit the wild populations. And that barely scratches the surface of what I think are the benefits for the animals. But it really is more about us being there to benefit them and people being able to come in and appreciate those animals in a different way.
I want us to talk more in this hour about those activities, about how you both see them. But I want to press right now on the question, perhaps trying to make a distinction between your intention and perhaps what you actually accomplish and what people, humans, take away from a visit to the zoo. It seems to me Dale Jamison was saying what we walk away with is a sense that we are on the top of this pyramid. That perhaps not consciously, but we walk away with a sense that this is all for us. All these creatures exist for us.
Actually, I think more in current zoos and especially in accredited zoos, people aren't walking away with a sense that this was for me in some way. They're walking away with a sense that they can have a very real impact on these animals and understanding not just these animals as unique species in the world, but a lot of the plight and the danger that these animals face in terms of their survival into the future. And people walk away from an experience at Maryland Zoo going, how can I make a difference? You know, I had no idea that elephants were declining at such a great rate. And you create a connection at a zoo that you can't get online. You can't get it by walking out in your backyard and walking through the Maryland wilderness. And how many people are ever going to actually get to go to Africa where they can have that single, personal, one-on-one look into the eye of an elephant and actually finally understand this is a unique and amazing animal that's different than anything in the world, and it deserves our respect, it deserves to be here. And in a zoo, you even have an added benefit, because not only are you getting that experience, but people are learning from us, the zoo professionals, that they can make an impact on ensuring that that animal does survive into the future.
That is Michael McClure, general curator of the Maryland Zoo here on WIPR on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Joining us by phone is Dale Jamison, founding director of Animal Studies and Environmental Studies at New York University. And we're talking about zoos, the cost and benefits of zoos for the animals. You're welcome to join this conversation. Millions of people visit zoos in the U.S. each year. Are you one of them? How do you feel about zoos? I'd love to get your thoughts on this. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Dale Jamieson, do you think that up-close and personal experience that Michael McClure described is something that can be replicated in some other way, that it's not necessary for the animals to be in close geographic proximity to where we live?
Yeah, yes, I do. And this is one of the problems I have often when I discuss these issues with zoo people like Michael. In some sense, we're all on the same side. I think we all love animals. We all want to protect nature. We have the same goals. You know, I'm in the business of environmental education. I run an environmental studies program. We have some idea of what education means and how to accomplish it. We have actually ways of benchmarking it and so on. And when it comes to the zoo world, you know, I hear a lot of rhetoric of the sort that Michael talks about, and a lot of it is, you know, very appealing and very engaging. But when it actually comes down to actually showing that people who visit zoos have in some way greener attitudes or more animal-friendly attitudes than other people, you know, it's just not there. And on the other, I mean, zoos have improved a lot when it comes to signage. You go to good zoos these days and there's all kinds of things to read. But generally when it comes to education, what we've discovered is having things for people to read doesn't necessarily affect their attitudes very much, especially in an age of computer simulation and virtual reality.
You mentioned having gone to the San Diego Zoo a lot as a kid. I came upon in reading several references to a study at the San Diego Zoo that showed that only a third of visitors seem to have picked up any scientific information, and in fact, about half that many of the visitors, about one-sixth, actually picked up false information. But then I discovered, as I kept seeing references to that one study, that it was about 30 years ago. It was sometime in the 80s. So I'm wondering, Michael McClure, whether zoos are doing a better job of testing that theory that you just told us about, that people learn about wildlife from visiting a zoo.
I absolutely believe that zoos are. In reference to the signage issue, I wouldn't disagree that, you know, people come and see signs and don't necessarily take away the right message all the time, but there's information available. You know, they can learn some facts about the animals. But what the difference is for us is, you know, you have this sign, but then standing 15 feet behind it, you've got a 8,000-pound African elephant. You've got, you know, 62 black-footed penguins. And the black-footed penguins are an endangered species. They're important to the world. We're losing them. African elephants are on the same path right now. And without people, you know, whether or not they read the sign, without people having that experience with that animal and talking to the people who are working with them and who understand them intimately and understand the threats they face, you're not going to be able to save these animals from extinction. There are countless examples of how zoos have worked to save animals from dying and leaving the planet, which is a huge travesty, in my opinion.
That's a good point. This is a good point for us to take a quick break and pick up on this question of what zoos do or what zoos can do about the extinction of so many species that's going on in the wild. We're going to continue our conversation with Michael McClure, general curator at the Maryland Zoo, and Dale Jamieson of New York University. And you can join this conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about zoos and whether or not they're a good idea. Joining me in the studio is Michael McClure, general curator at the Maryland Zoo. And joining us by phone is Dale Jamieson, professor of environmental studies and philosophy at New York University and an outspoken critic of zoos. I want to pick up. You were saying, Michael McClure, that zoos do a lot. Give me, if you can, briefly, a concrete example of something that the Maryland Zoo is doing to fight extinction.
One of our best examples is Panamanian golden frogs. Back in the 90s.
Panamanian golden frogs.
Golden frogs, yes, ma'am. In the 90s, we identified a very real threat to Panamanian golden frog survival in the wild. We worked with U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the government of Panama, and we collected some frogs for an assurance colony. The frogs have since gone functionally extinct in the wild. They don't exist in Panama anymore. We at the zoo have over 600 frogs. We have kept very pure genetics and bloodlines. We have mastered the breeding of these frogs in conjunction with many other accredited zoos under the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And there are over 2,000 frogs in Association of Zoos and Aquariums zoos right now. In 2 weeks, my herpetology collection manager is going down to Panama to help them work on their facilities, their life support, and their exhibits down there for helping the frogs breed.
This is at a zoo.
It's actually at just a conservation facility in Panama. And we are in talks with the Panamanian government and working towards re-releasing these frogs back into the wild. Perfect example of saving a species from extinction.
Dale Jamieson, what about that? You wrote, I think maybe 10 years ago or so, quote, "I do not believe zoos can successfully play this role," close quote, this role being staving off extinctions. So I don't want to put words into your mouth now, but I am curious as to whether when you hear Michael McClure describe the Panamanian golden frogs, what's your reaction?
So, again, it's not as though there aren't any successes, and it's not as though zoos do nothing to help when it comes to conservation. The problem fundamentally here is that we had this whole system of zoos that existed before these new sort of scientific and conservation justifications that they've taken on. If our focus is really conservation, we wouldn't have created this system of zoos that involve this kind of mass consumption, mass entertainment system that we have. It's that these limited conservation successes provide justifications for this system that really fundamentally exists for other purposes. Now, to kind of drill down a little on the examples, the fact is there are very few successful reintroductions. There are some, and they tend to get sort of trotted out as if in some way they're representative, but they're not. And if you actually look at the general extinction crisis that we face, you know, it's being driven by overconsumption, it's being driven by overpopulation, it's being driven by climate change. There's just simply not enough space in the world zoos to protect all of these animals, even if that was their primary goal. So if conservation is what we're interested in, as it should be, you know, then it's not as though, you know, zoos have nothing to do. I mean, you could put messages on McDonald's, you know, hamburger wrappers, and that might help in some small way about conservation. But it's not really getting to the source of the problem. And so to try to justify this whole system of zoos simply because there are a few zoos that are actually active in conservation and have some limited successes just really isn't enough to support this whole system, particularly when it comes to things like keeping animals in captivity. And I'd like to just for a minute come back to Michael's point about what do you see when you look in the eyes of the elephant, and this is in a zoo, and that this is a transformative experience. I have no doubt that when Michael looks in the eyes of an elephant, he's having a certain kind of experience. But what a lot of people see when they look in the eyes of a zoo elephant is they see a creature who's living in a kind of broken social situation, a creature that doesn't have the access to migration and kind of the natural forms of life. They're essentially seeing a creature that's living in a refugee camp as a result of human action. And the message that we need to get out there is that we need to respect nature. We need to respect animals. And respecting animals doesn't mean having them available at our pleasure, so we can go to a movie or we can go to a zoo or we can have a rock concert in a zoo or something like that.
Let me ask Michael McClure to respond to any of that that you want to.
There are many things there. Well, first of all, you're right. When I look into the eyes of an elephant or any of the really remarkable animals that we work with, I see different things than the public do. That is the connection, though. That's how we reach the public, the people who do come and don't understand these animals, who only see them as these glorified images that are anthropomorphized on television. We are the ones who are creating the messaging and helping them understand that there's more to them. In doing that, you take these very individual animals who are ambassadors for their species in every single way, and we relate the stories to people about each individual elephant, each individual golden frog even. And in doing so, you're then able to say, you know what, in addition to this, did you know that because of habitat loss, because of overcollection for the pet trade, Panamanian golden frogs no longer exist in the world? They exist here. We are doing amazing work. We have figured out how to deal with their breeding issues. We are working on solving all of the disease issues that these animals have. And because you came here today, and because you're interested in what I have to say to you, and because you've spent the time, you are helping us help these frogs to survive into the future and very likely to go back into the wild. I would also respond and just say this is not a limited or isolated case when it comes to the golden frogs. There are many species that zoos work with every single day, and we are moving towards conservation efforts for them that make sure that we save these species for the future.
We have lots of people who want...
Here we have a serious empirical disagreement. I mean, and I think essentially conservation biology is on my side on this one. I mean, I don't think people who work in this field generally think zoos have more than a marginal contribution to make, although, again, it gets brought out because it's such a major defense of zoos. It's the sort of thing that has to happen to get over that initial presumption that we talked about why keep all these animals in captivity and exhibit them to people for their pleasure. You'd better have some good scientific reason for doing that. So we talk about these relatively unusual examples.
And I think we're not going to be able to sort out on this show the size of the contribution and whether it is sufficient to justify. I do want to pull some of the, there's lots of people who want to be part of this conversation, and I'd like to pull them in. They've called us at 410-662-8780, and some have sent us emails, midday@wypr.org. Tyler has phoned us from Baltimore. Tyler, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you. My question is for Michael. So given that studies show that many animals can comprehend that they're being held in captivity, which can produce detrimental effects for the animal, do you justify holding an animal in captivity to study them and, in your eyes, help them in the wild from your studies? When the threat to these animals in the wild is humans, it seems like a double negative, humans keeping an animal in captivity to protect it from humans. It just seems cruel all around.
Tyler, thanks for the question. Michael?
It's a fair question. I guess I would have to say, Tyler, I'd like to see the study and understand what the data suggests. There are any number of quote-unquote studies that can point to any opinion that you want to validate and back. As far as keeping these animals in captivity goes, some of that is a value statement. We are basically saying that the word captivity is a negative thing, but if you look at many of the national parks over in Africa, define captivity for me. Many of the parks now have fences, they have boundaries, they have staff who are paid to take care of the quote-unquote wild animals to provide food for them. The conditions are really very similar to what we have here, and that's kind of a blurry line. I'm not sure that you can really draw that sharp of a distinction and say that captivity is an all-around bad thing.
That is Michael McClure, who is an elephant expert and general curator at the Maryland Zoo. We're also speaking with Dale Jamieson from New York University, a professor of environmental studies and philosophy, who has written a lot about zoos from a critical aspect. And we're taking your calls at 410-662-8780 and your emails at midday@wypr.org. Doug has called us from Hagerstown. Doug, welcome to Midday.
Hello?
Hello, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to know, Dale, how do you feel about aquariums any different than zoos, because for me, going to the Baltimore Aquarium, the National Aquarium, was such a formative experience when I was little, and it has stuck with me for my whole life, and really did give me an appreciation for those animals that I don't think I would have had, and I think to a lesser extent, zoos as well. And I also just wanted to say as a comment, even if zoos have a limited ability to save species, I just feel like we should try to save as many as we can. And as you know, in addition to looking at the root causes of overpopulation and many other things. So thank you.
Doug, I appreciate the call. Dale Jemison, he was directing that his comments particularly toward you.
So aquaria are in some ways similar, in some ways different, because our relations to the oceans are different than our relationship to the terrestrial biosphere. And it's also easier with aquaria to kind of have relatively free-range setups, as, for example, occurs in the case of the Monterey Aquarium, where you can sort of have animals that are sort of attracted to places where they can be viewed by people, but essentially are allowed to live independent lives. That's not the case for animals that are kept under serious confinement in zoos. The same critique, though, applies to things like aquaria that keep animals in complete and sort of total confinement and frustrating the kind of natural forms of life that they would otherwise engage in. I want to come back to this point about, well, even if zoos have only a limited ability to protect species, isn't that enough to justify their existence? And I want to say no. Just like if you're talking about the space program, for example, produced tang and all kinds of, you know, other sort of wonderful consumer projects. Was that enough to spend billions of dollars to send people to space? No. It's at best a sort of byproduct of this system. I mean, what we need to know is really two things. One is whether there are more effective and more efficient ways of doing conservation than this setup, which basically supports a system which is primarily entertainment in orientation and then sort of has these other kinds of spin-offs. And the other thing is there is a cost to having zoos. I mean, there are animal welfare issues. I mean, some of them actually are just quite serious and quite immediate. I mean, the gorilla case in the Cincinnati Zoo is an obvious case in point. I mean, an endangered species is being killed precisely because they're being, you know, exhibited in an entertainment function where this kind of thing is bound to happen. But there are other kinds of welfare issues, too. Now, zoos are a lot better than they used to be in a lot of ways, not all zoos and not all exhibits, but it's not as though this is a cost-free activity.
Michael McClure?
I go back to drawing the line at you know, saying that all a zoo does is entertainment. I don't think anyone who works in a zoo would argue that, you know, people come and should be entertained. People should have a good time. But there's much, much more going on that's incredibly relevant. That gorilla was not just there for entertainment. He was a valuable member of a species survival program that zoo is working in conjunction with other zoos under a very well-coordinated and organized program to save that species from extinction. Again, it goes back to, you know, we're working with these species. We are sharing our messages with the public. We are letting them see these animals in a different way. And at the end of the day, the goal for all zoos, and again, not just a limited number of species, it's everything we work with. We are trying to save them from disappearing from the planet and to continue them into the future of the world.
Janie has called us from Baltimore with an interesting idea. Janie, welcome to the show. Janie, are you with us?
I am. I'm an animal lover of the first order, and I am listening to both sides of this conversation and would like to make a suggestion. I'm wondering whether or not, in order to eliminate the confinement, the lifetime confinement of, let's say, a specific elephant, whether or not a species, elephants, could be rotated, all the animals could be rotated in and out of these confined experiences, tagged while they're there, studied, their health improved, and then released back into the wild, not after so long a period of time that they would have lost their ability to survive on their own, but in order to give both sides of the public an opportunity to feel that the animals are being treated fairly and that people are given the exposure to appreciate the animal kingdom and have a firsthand experience of how important this group of all these different species are to our survival.
Jenny, I have no idea if this would work. Michael McClure, what do you think? Rotation?
We don't have time to cover this question.
Has anyone tried it? I mean, is this an idea elsewhere?
Well, certainly we haven't talked about rotating so much, but some of the basic issues that you face with that are biosecurity issues. With our golden frogs in particular, for example, we brought these animals in with the full intention of returning them to the wild, but it would be future progeny from the breedings. And to do that, we have for over a decade maintained very, very careful biosecurity protocols that have ensured the welfare of the frogs, kept the genetics pure, kept the bloodlines separate, and also made certain that the frogs are healthy and very well, very fit, so that when we do decide to move them back, we could do that. Now, with something like a rhinoceros, just the transport alone would be something that I would say would be too stressful. You know, you're bringing the animal in and then shifting it back out, and you're doing this constant push-pull for the sake of rotating, and I would not be an advocate of that. But what they do have is similar to one comment that you made, Jamie, was, you know, can you take these animals and get them healthier and then release them back? That's some of the field work that does go on in the wild on a daily basis, and zoos support that. We are, again, supporting those animals and their health and their welfare and ensuring they last and survive. And zoos contribute over $150 million a year to field studies, field work. And
it's
some
in,
of that work
in
is
wild.
In the wild, in the range countries. And if I may really quick respond to something Dale said, I disagree that all conservationists feel that zoos don't have a value. We have partners all over the world. Every accredited zoo works with field studies, field researchers who see the value in the public engagement that we get in zoos. Not only that, we provide data that the field researchers do not have access to. When you have these animals that are in this environment and we have 24-hour a day, 7 days a week, direct contact with them, we can acquire biological samples through voluntary means by training the animals. We can study their behaviors up close. We can do things like an elephant study that we did recently where we provided confirmed footprint data of dimension, size, and length of specific footprints. We were able to obtain specific weights of the elephants, measurements, age, and we took that information and shared it with a researcher who is working on developing a database for being able to do the same thing with wild elephants. And it validated her database so that she could then collect more valid data on the wild populations.
Well, Dale Jamieson, we need to take a break. Would you like to make a quick response to anything Michael just said, or should we take a break and come back?
Well, let me take a very quick response to this, and then I'd like to come back to something about Harambee. I mean, the question here with Michael's point is whether all of these stories and these anecdotes actually add up to a really rigorous empirical justification for zoos. And I think, again, you can tell stories all day long, but I think these stories are the exceptional ones. But as I say, I think the Harambee case provides a really nice point of focus here. And I'd like to come back to it.
Okay, let's take this break, and we'll talk more when we get back with Dale Jamieson, Founding Director of Animal Studies and Environmental Studies at New York University, and with Michael McClure, General Curator at the Maryland Zoo, and your calls and comments. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or email us at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking about zoos and whether they are a good idea. Here with me in the studio is Michael McClure, a general curator at the Maryland Zoo. He's an expert on elephants in particular. And by phone, we're joined by Dale Jamieson, founding director of Animal Studies and Environmental Studies at New York University. We were talking actually before we were talking about the incident on Memorial Day weekend at the Cincinnati Zoo, where a 4-year-old climbed under a railing and across a fence and ended up then tumbling into the enclosure of an endangered gorilla. The point that you and the zoo saw no way to protect the child except to shoot and kill the gorilla, whose name was Harambe. The point you wanted to make about that, Dale Jamieson?
Well, Michael was making the very important point about gorillas being a very close relatives, being a highly endangered species, and how important it should be to all of us, I think, who have environmental values and respect animals, to try to protect them. And then Michael was saying how important the activities of the Cincinnati Zoo are to this and to getting this message out about the importance of protecting these animals. The problem in the first instance is that if we really want to protect apes, this has absolutely nothing to do with exhibiting them to people. And when you exhibit them to people, conflicts inevitably arise. And when conflicts arise, they get resolved in favor of people. And all of a sudden, this message about how incredibly important it is to protect these gorillas suddenly collapses into an ambiguous situation. Of course, we have to protect the child. And this background frame that humans are more important than other animals asserts itself as being the real message. So if you really want to protect gorillas, as we should, then get them. And don't put them in these situations where you're going to have these encounters with people. It's kind of a slogan in animal behavior that when a wild animal comes into contact with people, one of two things happens. Either they become a dead animal or they're no longer a wild animal. And zoos try to thread that needle, but it's not very easy to succeed.
Michael McClure?
One comment real quick. The concept that these animals are no longer wild animals is not accurate. I can tell you with certainty, I've worked with a lot of animals both in the range countries and at the zoo, and I did that because I wanted to go and see how these animals behave. Do the behaviors line up? Are they the same? And these animals are no different than the ones that are in the wild. Certainly, they have learned behaviors that we train them to do in a zoo setting that we use to benefit them for their husbandry needs, for research purposes, things like that. But I was quite pleased and relieved to find out that the behaviors I saw in the wild in young elephants, old elephants, lions, cheetahs, they mirrored everything that I see in the animals that I've worked with for over 25 years now. I think that that's a really important distinction to make, and that we're putting kind of a human projection on it when we say the wild is gone in them. And the reality of that statement, too, is, what's wild anymore? As I mentioned earlier, national parks managed by people. People are there. These field conservationists who are doing remarkable work with a lot of these species out in Africa, in Asia, in South America, the first thing they'll tell you is, you know, they go out and dart a lion and are working on it, and what's the biggest threat to them doing that very important work that helps to ensure that we're saving that species? But the biggest threat to them is actually elephants. You know, elephants are a threat to people when they're doing that kind of work out in the wild, too. So I feel like the Harambe situation is a very isolated incident in zoos. And when you put people and animals together, sometimes those things are going to happen. And it is terribly unfortunate for all involved, especially the gorilla, the zoo, and the family of the child.
Several people are contacting us about their childhood experiences. And before we talk to Rachel in Annapolis, I want to read from Denise describing a situation from a long time ago. Denise says, it was 61 years ago, but I remember it like it was yesterday. Our parents took us to the zoo. The elephant was behind the thick bars in a dark, dank concrete room. He was rocking side to side. Even at 3 or 4 years old, I knew I was seeing a very sad animal. I didn't like the zoo, but was too young to articulate this to my parents. I'm glad I'm finally getting the chance. And then a very different memory from Jim, who wrote, As a child, my daughter loved going to the Baltimore Zoo. We took her 15 to 25 times a year at her insistence. As a result of this experience, she, years later, applied for and was accepted to the Tufts Vet School, graduated, and is now a doctor. Without this early exposure to animals in the world, I doubt she would be where she is today. With that preface, Rachel in Annapolis has called us. Rachel, welcome to Midday.
Hi, I definitely feel like my young experiences going to both zoos, like the Bronx Zoo and the Washington, D.C. Zoo, made a huge impact on my love for animals. And I have been involved in all different facets of animals since then in my life. I'm a physical therapist, but I also sometimes help rehabilitate animals. I've worked with animal rescue groups to restore proper homes and things, but I think zoos can be such an educational opportunity. I do think that we should be attentive of the welfare they get while they're in those environments to make sure that they're not being mistreated, but I do think they're a valuable learning experience for young children all over the world.
Rachel, I appreciate the call. Dale Jamieson, would you like to react to that?
Yeah, sure. Once again, we all tend to have the experiences we have and then highly generalize them, and the question is what all these anecdotes come to. But if you, again, look at zoos as institutions and you sort of get past the kind of signage and the kinds of messages that are being given, what are they really doing? Well, zoo gift shops are often temples to consumption, and we know that consumption is one of the drivers that's leading us to off this environmental precipice. The question is really, are zoos really fundamentally about addressing the environmental crisis, or are they really fundamentally about self-perpetuation? And I think they're fundamentally, like all institutions, they're not like universities or anything else, they're about self-perpetuation. Conservation and science is now the kind of respectable way of doing that, and so sure, they do something in that area. But if we're serious about these environmental issues and protecting animals, the solutions are not fundamentally in zoos, and there's not much evidence that, people may like zoos, they may not like zoos, but there's not much evidence that people's experience in zoos actually lead them to do what we really need to do to address the drivers of environmental degradation.
Michael McClure?
I guess I would say that at its most basic level, I go back to you have to connect people to the natural world. You have to connect them to the animals. Putting conservation messaging on a McDonald's wrapper is not going to make somebody want to save an animal that they don't see and don't connect to. We do a really remarkable job of putting people in front of creatures that, again, they would not see otherwise. They would not experience otherwise. They would not evaluate for themselves. And yes, I fully recognize some people are going to walk away with different experiences. But for zoos and for the animals that we're all championing in the world, we are looking for the people who are going to help us get on board, invest in saving these animals, spread that message to other people. And it has a positive effect. I'm not sure how we can really just say that zoos are strictly an entertainment institution. Yes, we do have gift shops. But gift shops are places where we talk about the animals. We sell animal paintings and talk about the individual and help them understand how that animal exists in the world. And that money certainly doesn't go into anyone's pockets. It goes back into conservation efforts. It goes back into good welfare for the animals. It goes back into ensuring that we have excellent staff and excellent resources to continue making sure these species are surviving. For instance, our zoo, and this is sort of a hidden thing in our zoo, but it's there, we have the world's largest repository of biological samples on the endangered mountain gorillas because our head veterinarian from years ago was connected to animals through zoos and decided he wanted to champion this species, which is absolutely critically endangered in the world. And Maryland Zoo in Baltimore is still continuing that work with him.
Russ is calling us from Towson with a question for Dale. Russ, our time is growing short, so.
Hi there. I've heard this topic talked about a lot, and I would ask your person there from NYU, you're advocating along with a lot of people nowadays about these animals in zoos and aquariums as if they're the animals in the world that need the most help, and the reality is that there are millions of animals every single year that are dying in horrible conditions, living horrible lives, sometimes never seeing the sun or rarely seeing the sun in the food industry. And while you're advocating for trying to help these animals in zoos who get top-notch veterinary care, serve as ambassadors to their species, these days in accredited zoos typically live in habitats that reflect their natural environment. There are these other millions of animals that actually do need help, and that would include animals in the pet industry as well. Who's advocating for them, you know? And I'm sure that, you know, while you talk about zoos, you have a chicken sandwich for lunch, you're supporting truly horrendous conditions for animals while talking about helping animals that they don't need the kind of help that you're advocating for.
Russ, I appreciate the question. Dale Jamieson, how would you respond?
Well, honestly, I think most of the same people who are skeptical of zoos and critical of zoos are also the same people who really oppose what's going on in factory farming and animal agriculture. If anything, if you want to think about an inconsistency here, there's something a little odd about, you know, chowing down on a cheeseburger while sort of admiring the wonderfulness and greatness of these animals that you're seeing in zoos. So I actually think if there's an inconsistency, it tends to be on the side of people who want to support zoos and not the other way around. Before we get off, I think I would like to get back to what I think is really the fundamental difference between Michael and me. Is this the moment to do that? Or
let me just ask this very quickly from someone who emailed us. Can you explain why the idea that humans are superior to animals is wrong? I feel pretty superior to the animals in my life. I don't know what my dog would do without me. Dale?
Yeah, well, that's a pretty long story, but I think if you take a broadly naturalistic perspective, a kind of Darwinian perspective, you'll see humans as essentially one species among many that inhabit the planet, not so different in most ways than Harambee. And it's hard to justify why there should be some very particular moral prerogative that attaches to all and only humans, but that's a much longer
conversation. That is a longer thing, but I wish you would make the point that you think needs to be made. Because we are in our final minutes.
So here's the thing. So Michael believes, and he may be right about this, I hope he's not, that in order for people to be motivated to protect things and to save things, they have to come into direct contact with them. And that's an important part of the argument for zoos. Now, I think, first of all, if that's really true about what we're like, we really can't protect what we don't come in direct contact with, then we're even worse trouble than I would imagine when it comes to the environmental crisis. Because if we have to be in wild places, if we have to see animals in order to protect them, then we're just going to love them to death. Because 7.3 billion people who have to come in contact with what they want to save is simply just going to be another way of destroying it.
I need to give Michael McClure the last half minute. If there's something you want to say.
Sure. I would just say that, you know, I'm not saying that direct contact is the only way. But, you know, there's an old saying, tell me I'll forget, show me I might remember, involve me and you change my life. That's the premise. You know, when we involve people in these animals directly, they get an experience that's singular, that's different than anything else, and could potentially change their life. And that leads us to being able to further our goals of being able to save species from extinction. It's what we do.
We are flat out of time, and I want to thank you both, Michael McClure, General Curator and Elephant Manager at the Maryland Zoo.
Thank you.
And Dale Jamieson, Professor of Environmental Studies and Philosophy at New York University. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheila, and Michael, you as well.
And I want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today, a full-service market, locations on North Charles and Roland Avenue, on the web at eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. We'll speak with U.S. Congressman Elijah Cummings about the Democratic platform, policing in America, and more. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.